We're going to move on to the last case of today, and that is Appeal 02430, United Corporation versus Employees Insurance of Warsaw. And Mr. Wheaton.
Yes, ma'am. Good morning. May I please report? In Wheaton versus Carousel Handbags, the Second Circuit held that a district court has no discretion to withhold an order in civil contempt awarding damages, including attorney's fees, if violation is willful. Now, in its complaint, a notice alleged willful violations of an order and willful misrepresentations to the court. If you stay within the four corners of the complaint, I obviously wouldn't be here. Yet, on a motion brought under Rule 12b-6, in a case which I think is fairly characterized as complex, the bankruptcy court chose to look to some parts of the record in other related proceedings while ignoring others.
But civil contempt has to rest on something, and I think that the problem I had with your argument was that there were various premises all through your presentation that I think are contestable. Just for example, what's the scope of this order of August 14, 2000, referring to judgments entered in favor of the Sala class plaintiffs? Another issue that's contestable is whether what we're looking at are administrative priority expenses or simple general creditor claims. Those all affect whether anything has happened that would trigger the court's civil contempt power, which isn't your ordinary 12b-6 kind of complaint. It's a special power of the court.
That was my point exactly. I agree with everything you said, and I intend to address each of those issues. But the setting in which these were addressed, I believe, would be more appropriate at a minimum on a motion for summary judgment on a fuller record, or perhaps more appropriate at a trial.
Well, why does the bankruptcy court need a summary judgment motion to construe its own order?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, the order is not the bankruptcy court's order. It was an order prepared by counsel that it signed. My point is, if you read the transcript, when the judge said he was going to sign that order, he relied in so many words on this court's decision in Bernstrom and in Shondell. And the fair reading of those opinions say that it's appropriate to vacate the automatic stay or the post-discharge injunction in circumstances where there will be no monetary impact on the debtor.
And the only thing that happens here, first of all, I really want to take exception to this idea that if counsel prepared an order that the bankruptcy judge didn't read it, that he just put blinders on and rubber stamped it, because I have no reason to believe that without something to support that allegation that that's what happened. Secondly, if you join the group of unsecured creditors, then you are, in fact, not affecting the distribution of the estate. There's no priority that's being given. Nobody's getting anything extra. And if that's what this means, then nothing has happened.
Well, first, Judge Wood, I think you misunderstood what I said, and you took it the wrong way. I apologize. I think the meaning of what of the order is in the transcript when the bankruptcy judge explained why he was signing that order that was prepared by counsel. And I don't think that it's inappropriate for me to suggest that you need to read what the judge said when he says, I'm about to sign this order and let me tell you why. I think that those statements from the bench by the judge are important and should be taken into account by this court in construing the order. Now, the judge can construe his order, but he can't ignore it. When he signed the order, he said, I'm relying on Fernstrom and Shondell.
When he says it won't have any effect on the determination of the amount of the Sala class action plaintiffs allowed claims filed in this bankruptcy, why do you think we should read that to mean anybody's claims on the estate?
Because, Your Honor,
notices or anyone else's.
Because this court in both Fernstrom and Shondell said that vacating the automatic stay in these circumstances is appropriate because it would have no monetary impact on the bankruptcy state.
You know, he didn't respond to Patrick versus Ford.
And I'm really wondering what your response to that would be. Because, you know, there we said there's no such thing as an independent corporate action for civil contempt. I mean, I'm really sitting here wondering whether you can even assert a claim here. Because...
Your Honor, there is no independent claim in the sense that any claim for relief for violating willful disobedience of a court order must be brought before the court that issued the order. And when you talk about independence, as I understand that claim, I couldn't take, assume hypothetically that you have a body of facts that everybody admits constitutes civil contempt that occurred before the Northern District of Indiana. And if a defendant was amenable in the Central District of California, I couldn't take those facts that everybody agrees entitles me to write, say this is an independent cause of action, I'm going to file it in the Central District of California. That's what I believe that case stands for, and no more, because I think you've got to, I think you have to take into account the Wheaton versus Carousel decision as well, which talks about what we're talking about in this case, not the ability to file some separate lawsuit based upon allegedly contemptuous conduct before in some different court or in the same court before even a different judge. That's what those cases talk about. Before I run out of time, I really want to talk about Jartran and Judge Wood's suggestion that our claim, which is set forth in so many words in the adversary complaint, is not an administrative expense. No one here, I think, would pause for a moment to question that if a trustee, which is by definition a post-petition creature, hires a lawyer to defend a lawsuit, the lawyer's fees and out-of-pocket expenses are entitled to administrative priority. Keeping that thought in mind, look at the bankruptcy court's decision in the Notice versus Wausau, the November 7 decision. We are a disbursing agent under this contract with respect to insurance. To whatever extent that Wausau or any other insurance company is entitled to a fee by reason of a demand for performance under the insurance contract, we pay it and we're entitled to dollar-for-dollar reimbursement. That is no different than the airplane tickets that were used as the hypothetical in Jartran. The fact that we're the dispersing agent rather than the debtor being the direct dispersing agent, I submit, is a distinction without a difference. Everything we have to pay, they're entitled to. Now, when the trustee makes a post-petition demand for the provision of services under one or more of these insurance contracts, right, thus incurring lawyers work post-petition, they incur expenses post-petition, the bills come post-petition, under Jartran, our claim is entitled to administrative priority. And if it's entitled to administrative priority, let's think about Fernstrom, let's think about the motion to vacate the automatic stay. They come in and say, please let us proceed, it's going to have no monetary impact on the estate. Where are we today? Where we are today is every penny that Wausau represented to the court, it was, quote, paying, unquote, is administrative expense against the debtor. Now, if that's
not... But it might also, I mean, these are all, of course, stemming from long pre-petition contractual arrangements, so we have a characterization issue minimum. But again, putting to one side the very serious question about civil contempt, with non-administrative expense, they aren't doing anything. I mean, Wausau's making some payments and their rights to reimbursement, but they wind up as unsecured claims against the estate.
Your Honor, first of all, when the contract was entered into is not the relevant time.
It is any relevant time, sometimes. Jartran was one situation with the airplane tickets. This is a rather different situation from the one.
It is a different situation because post-petition, a trustee who didn't exist pre-petition made a demand that had an expense for which the estate is liable. That's the difference. Everything to which...
Why did this preserve the estate rather than deplete it? One of the requirements for something to be an administrative expense is that it be made for purposes of preserving the estate, such as perhaps buying an insurance policy. This, as far as I can tell, there's nothing but deplete the estate.
Well, Your Honor, Jartran says it has to benefit the estate, not preserve the estate. And when an estate...
Why would the unsecured creditors that the trustee is representing think that this benefited the estate?
Your, Your Honor, the issue is not what the unsecured creditors think. The legal question is, does this benefit the estate? And the elimination of a claim against a party is clearly a benefit. If A sues B and the lawsuit goes away, it's a benefit, is it not?
It's a benefit if you don't deplete your assets, but they're going to deplete their assets under your theory of the case.
Exactly correct. And the adversary...
Why does that benefit the estate, to deplete the assets?
Your Honor, the adversary complaint alleges in so many words that the trustee was misled into believing that when Wausau said it was going to pay its policy limits, it meant pay its policy limits, and was not going to boomerang so that the estate ended up with an administrative expense dollar for dollar. You have to separate the two. First, what are our rights under Jartran? For the reasons I believe I've explained, this is entitled to administrative priority. Because all of the conduct by the trustee, all of the conduct that resulted in the creation
okay,
of the
trustee. Okay, I think you've covered this, yeah. Thank you very much. All right, Mr. McNair.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Dan McNamara. I was sitting back there this morning. It dawned on me that I've never been the appellee before in an appeal, so I'm a little disoriented.
Well, would you like to be turned back into...
No, I would not. I think that the
situation for the next court, I mean, we can do anything for you.
The case is about a claim of contempt. Claim of contempt in as to two respects. The first being respect to what we've referred to as the August 14th order, and the second being the behavior of Wausau in asking for approval by the bankruptcy court of a settlement. And we don't get to a discussion about administrative priorities unless we get past the contempt issue. As to the violation or alleged violation of the August 14th order, there can be no contempt claim made for a variety of reasons. First of all, there's no standing. The notice was not a party to the proceeding. It didn't request the order. The law, as you well know, for making a contempt claim, is that there must be a clear and unequivocal order bearing the imprimatur of an injunction, and the order must specifically prohibit the acts complained of. This order was not directed to Wausau. Wausau is not a party to it. And in any sense, how did Wausau, or could Wausau, have violated it? What the order did, and this is common in bankruptcies, is reserve the issue of claims allowance to the bankruptcy court subsequent to a determination and liquidation of a liability in the Salah class action. And at best, the order would be deemed ambiguous. And if that's the case, it precludes the possibility that an unequivocal order has been violated. Many of the same arguments apply to the allegation of contempt for failing to disclose its true intent, Wausau, in seeking a settlement. First of all, I submit that that argument was waived in the following respects. The notice had notice of the proposed settlement. It saw the documentation. It did not object. It did not attend the hearing. And it did not appeal the court's order approving the settlement. Secondly, to the extent the notice is arguing that the trustee was somehow duped, the notice lacks standing. The notice would have to have a colorable claim. I'm sorry, there must have been a colorable claim, an unjustified refusal by the debtor or the trustee to pursue that claim, and leave of the bankruptcy court by the creditor in notice to pursue the claim itself. None of that is present in this case. And lastly, there's simply no evidence of deceit. The document, as the bankruptcy court noted on review, the document submitted for review specifically says, Wausau reserves the rights it has to seek redress against third parties. A notice is a third party.
I suppose the one thing it didn't do was spell out the chain that under this particular set of insurance agreements was going to happen. You know, Walsall turning to a notice having then the right to turn to consolidated and right back into the bankruptcy estate. So the question might be whether the bankruptcy court was aware that it was creating new claims against the estate.
I believe that the wording, the language, the express reservation in the statement would clearly satisfy whatever obligation Walsall had, and the bankruptcy court agreed.
But the possibility of Walsall's resort to the letter of credit and the ramifications for the debt are something that the trustee and the other parties even considered when the settlement with the class action plaintiffs, was approved.
Your Honor, I'm not sure quite who you mean by the other parties, but certainly in notice was well aware of it. And as to the trustee, this ties in, I think, with the question of whether or not this would, in the end, be a claim entitled to administrative priority. The trustee understood that a notice would have at most an unsecured claim to share pro rata with the other unsecured creditors.
Do we know anything about the size of this estate? How much one more unsecured claim would dilute the possibility of recovery from the other unsecured creditors? Is this one of these that no one is going to get more than 2 cents on the dollar anyway? What's the estate like?
I don't know the size. I know it was a converted from a Chapter 11 to a Chapter 7.
Yeah.
In any event, it's further evidence of what the understanding was. You just might ask, why hasn't the trustee sought to revoke this settlement? There are no other questions. I'm finished. Thank you.
Your time has been used, but I will give you a minute.
Standing comes from our canceled $500,000 check. There is evidence of deceit. The trustee had, the debtor before him and later the trustee had sued Walsall saying, pre-petition, we paid everything we owe you. The liability for all of this is on you. At the hearing, the bankruptcy judge looked the lawyers in the eye and said, because the trustee was getting $50,000 more from Walsall than it said its policy limits was, he said, therefore, you are doing better than you could have done in this declaratory judgment adversary proceeding. You are doing better than you could have done. And Walsall's lawyers stood silent. That's not deceit. Then I'm seven.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Benson. And thank you, Mr. McNamara. And the case will be taken under advisement, and the court will stand in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:30. Thank you, everyone.
Architectural questions. I think